Thank you. Thank you very much. And just a few preliminary comments. Thank you for persevering to the end of these lectures. I think this is a little hot. I think it's maybe it should just be brought down just a touch. I figured by the time we got to the end of the week, we would have the remnant here. So good for you. I realize that we're on the eve of fall break. I really appreciate your coming out for this lecture. And you have been richly rewarded by this huge commentary on Exodus. A couple of apologies about it. First of all, I begged the publisher to do it in two volumes rather than one big volume. But for whatever reason, you know, those are the things publishers decide, not authors. When we first received copies of this Exodus commentary, which is dedicated to my son, James Maxwell, he was 4 years old, and his mother went up to his bedroom, and he was there in bed, ready for his bedtime story and bedtime singing and all that good stuff, and he had the Exodus commentary on his lap, and he said, "Mom, when is somebody going to read me my book?" And she said, "Well, honey, it doesn't have any pictures." And he said, "Oh." She said, "Would you like to read something else?" He said, "Yeah." So I don't know if he'll ever read the book that was dedicated to him, but I'm glad you have a copy, and hope you may find it useful. One of the most gratifying things for me is somebody who writes some expository commentaries that are designed for people who preach and teach the Bible is hearing from people in ministry who have said, seeing your commentary inspired me to go ahead and preach this book of the Bible, or this was so helpful. This was one of the things I really relied on. It's been good for my congregation to be in this book of the Bible. And in fact, I just got a note like that just in the last couple days, somebody that preached through Exodus, I might have mentioned earlier in the week. So I hope you have a chance to benefit from studying Exodus and perhaps teaching or preaching Exodus or sharing that book with somebody else who will, something like that. I think one of the values or benefits of lectures like the Mullins lectures is if you are preparing for ministry, and particularly if you are preparing for pastoral ministry, having some exposure to people on campus, speaking on campus, who give you a little bit of the flavor, the atmosphere, the passion of pastoral ministry. And I dare say there are some faculty members here that give that to you. Certainly Herschel York is one of those with the pastoral ministry that he exercises. You're getting something of the flavor or atmosphere of pastoral ministry just from having somebody like that on campus. But many of your seminary faculty, that's not their calling, that's not their context. So I think it was a great vision that the Mullinses had for bringing some pastors on campus to talk about preaching. And hopefully you're picking up a little bit of a passion for teaching and preaching the Bible from some of the things I'm presenting. And thinking and praying about how has God designed you uniquely to teach and to preach the Bible. I think as I look back on a lot of the mentors I've had tremendous opportunities to be up close and personal with some amazing ministers. Some well-known, some not well-known at all, but well-known to me. And I like to think that there's a little piece of a lot of those different people that's part of the ministry that I have without my ever having tried to imitate any particular one of them, which I think is probably unhelpful. But I'm here partly to give you a sense of atmosphere, of passion for preaching God's word, but I'm also supposed to give you a few things that are methodological. I think that's what the Mullins has had in mind, a method of preaching. And I've tried to do that in a couple of topic areas that I think are less frequently talked about or covered. I mean, I'm sure many of you, if you're in an MDiv program, people have talked to you about sermon structure and, you know, going from the text to your outline and some of those basics. What I want to talk about in this lecture is approaching a book of the Bible as a whole. I'm going to use Exodus as an illustration or example of that. I'm sure by the time I'm done with what I'm going to do this afternoon, you can just give that commentary to somebody else, because you'll have the book of Exodus in a nutshell from what we're going to do. I do think it is very important for us to work as hard as we can to understand and identify the thematic unity of the book of a book of the Bible. And one assumption I'm making is that at least in some of the teaching and preaching we do, we're simply working our way through the scriptures chapter by chapter, verse by verse. I won't go into all the reasons why I think that's an excellent, healthy, regular diet for a congregation or for a Bible study. But that's kind of the assumption that I bring. That a lot of the preaching I'm going to do, I'm just going to work my way through a book of the Bible. And I want to be asking the question, how do I approach that? How do I think about that? And part of my approach to that is I will identify a book of the Bible that I'm going to preach at some point in the future, and then simply try to be reading that book frequently in the months, maybe even years leading up to that time. Not necessarily taking lots of detailed notes, just immersing a little bit in that book. There may be some amazingly fruitful thoughts that come to me during that reading, and if I come up with a really great idea or insight or connection, I definitely want to write that down. The other thing that I do a lot of in preparing to preach is I save illustrations, examples, quotations, stories. If I read something good in the if you're just even reading the whatever your publication here is here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, there's going to be a testimony in there from somebody that's gone through a trial and there was a particular Bible verse that was significant for them, or maybe there's a nice short article on a particular book of the Bible you think it has some good things to say. I save all of those things in folders, so that when I'm really getting ready to start outlining a book in detail, I already have, hopefully, a nice amount of illustrative material, great quotations, things that are really going to help me teach or preach that book of the Bible. The other thing I want to be thinking about as I'm reading a book of the Bible with advanced preparation for preaching is, what holds this all together? What is the main thrust? Can I be as precise as possible about the theme of this book? And I usually discover about partway through a sermon series that I had it a little bit wrong or mostly wrong. Usually by the time I get to the end of preaching a book of the Bible, I want to start all over again, go back to the beginning, really do it right this time, because there are things I understand so much better now at the end than I did at the beginning. But I think even if you go through that kind of revision in what you think is the main theme of something, even having tried to make an attempt to identify that theme and then having to revise it, that itself is going to be helpful for you in your preaching and also helpful for your congregation. So what I want to talk about this afternoon is identifying the melodic line in the book of Exodus. I think I gave it a slightly different title than what I gave to the seminary, but this phrase melodic line comes from the teaching of Dick Lucas. Dick Lucas at St. Helen Bishopsgate in London, Anglican Church, terrific Bible expositor for many, many years, had a thriving midweek Bible teaching time that he did for business people in the heart of London's financial district. And he has some teaching principles that he likes to give on preaching, and one of these is finding the melodic line. That is the main theme, something that can give coherence to a series of sermons or messages, something that will help provide an interpretive context for any particular passage in the Bible, in the book, something that perhaps emerges with greater and greater clarity as we study the book. Now, I say the main theme of a book, but there are also other literary units in the Bible. Sometimes you have a book of the Bible that has cycles of stories within the book, and those story cycles may themselves have a unifying theme. The Elijah narratives, arguably, have a more specific melodic line than 1 Kings taken as a whole, for example. The Joseph cycle has a different melodic line than the Abraham cycle in Genesis. You might think of God meant it for good and something having to do with God's sovereign provision as somehow connected to the melodic line of Joseph. You definitely would want to say something about living by faith in God's covenant promise for Abraham. Maybe those two parts of the book are part of a bigger theme of land and seed as covenant promise. These are some of the ideas that may come close to a theme for the book of Genesis. The point I'm simply making is that parts of a literary whole can have their own unifying theme. And I think the principle of looking for a melodic line is based on the literary unity of the Bible. There's a logical, literary, theological coherence to the different parts of the Bible, and also there's a melodic line to the Bible as a whole. It's so extraordinary, the remarkable unity of the Bible as a whole. These literary works written over the course of centuries in all different kinds of genres, coming in some cases from very different cultures, and yet by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, an extraordinary unity and coherence of the Bible as a whole. Sometimes in working on a melodic line, you will get a very explicit statement of authorial intention that may give you a very good start on identifying a melodic line. I think Luke perhaps is a good example of that. Luke's very clear both in Acts and in Luke about his intentions. He's tells his reader, Theophilus, that it seemed good to him, having made careful investigation, to write in orderly sequence such things that you may know the certainty of the things about which you have been instructed. There's an emphasis on assurance that comes through in the Gospel of Luke. John is another gospel that gives a very clear statement of authorial intention, in his case, at the end of the gospel. Sometimes the melodic line will be less explicitly stated, but is implicit in the narrative itself. One example you might think of is Ruth. You get a very climactic announcement of the coming of David at the end. This has something to do about the coming of a king. But that's only hinted at the beginning of the book with the reference to Bethlehem. And to understand Ruth's melodic line, you maybe have to see it in its canonical context, understand the end of Judges when there's a desperate plea for a king and a need for a king, also the following context in Samuel of the development of a kingdom. But whether it's explicit or implicit, we're looking for a unifying theme. And it is characteristic of well-constructed literary works, especially works that have a didactic or pedagogical purpose, that they do have a predominant theme. There's a literary unity. C.S. Lewis writes very effectively about this, about the way really great works of literature have a kind of irreplaceable atmosphere about them. Interestingly, if you're familiar with Lewis's Narnia Chronicles, you see how strongly that is the case of his own writings, because there's an atmosphere around The Voyage of the Dawn Treader that's totally different than the atmosphere around The Silver Chair, around The Last Battle. And there are feelings you could not even really articulate that go with your reading experience of that work. You cannot have that same reading experience by reading any other work except that work. I think the Bible is strongly that way as well. Invariably, if I'm announcing that I am preaching on a particular book of the Bible, here's what's coming next for a campus or for a congregation, I'll have people come up to me and they'll say, oh, I love that book. And they're already entering into the feelings that they associate and the thoughts they associate with that particular book of the Bible. And I think a thematic unity, a melodic line, is part of what creates that experience for us. Now, let me just give a couple qualifiers to all of that before I get into Exodus. I'm not saying there's always only one theme. In a great work of literature, there are also other strong motifs. You might make an analogy to a symphony, for example, or a movement in a symphony. You have a melodic line, but you also have harmonies that relate to that melodic line. You also have shorter musical motifs that enter into the symphony as a whole. So even when there's a main melodic line, there are other musical parts or literary parts that connect to that melody, and they are musically significant in the case of music, or I think literarily significant in the case of literature. You may also have, and there may be a real complexity to the melodic line. John, I think, would be an example of that. He announces at the end that you may believe and have life in his name. But then if you look at John chapter 1, and see the coming of the light and new creation and the glory of God dwelling with his people and the coming of grace and truth. These are also strong themes in the book that you can trace all the way through the book. John 1 is a little bit like listening to an orchestra tune up, and you can hear the oboist play a little part of one melody, and you hear a violinist practicing another little part of the melody, and then as the symphony unfolds, all of that music is presented in its beauty. There's a real complexity to it in the Gospel of John. So I don't want to be overly simplistic about this, but I do think it is still helpful to try to identify a melodic line in the book, and I think that's true to the literary character of the Bible. I think it's a good way to begin understanding a book. I think it helps in our outlining of a book. I think it gives some coherence to a series of sermons or talks or messages through a book. I like to have a sense as a congregation or maybe as a small group that we're on a journey together. We have a certain excitement about what we're going to discover, and a camaraderie that unifies us around the unity of a biblical text. And for all of these reasons, I also think often identifying a melodic line helps you see particular passages in greater clarity. So it's an aid to interpretation. You have a sense of how it fits into the wider book. Now, let's illustrate all of this by talking about Exodus. And one of the problems with Exodus, frankly, is what to do after chapter 20. And more than once, I've talked to somebody that's excited, they're preaching through Exodus, and we talk about it a little bit, and then they kind of sheepishly admit, well, actually, we're only doing, you know, up to Exodus 15, or maybe up to Exodus 20. You know, the early chapters of Exodus, you have so many things that are really going for you. In terms of an epic adventure, all kinds of drama. You have a genocidal villain in Pharaoh, an improbable hero in Moses. You have some big narrative setbacks. I mean, you know, Moses trying initially to deliver the Israelites one Egyptian at a time, and that doesn't go so well, and there's a big setback in the story. You've got all kinds of great special effects, the burning bush, the nasty plagues, amazing dialogue between God and Moses, between Moses and Pharaoh. There's violence with the angel of death. There's huge battle scenes leading up to and into the Red Sea. You've got some nice musical numbers in chapter 15. You've got some really good arguments in the wilderness. You have amazing, stunning, dramatic backdrops. Egypt, the Nile, Mount Sinai. I mean, it's everything that you could want in an adventure. And then you have the giving of the law in chapter 20, maybe not quite as dramatic, but a lot of mileage you can get out of that in preaching, you know, particularly because it deals with a lot of sins that people kind of like to commit. But you kind of get up to that point, and it's easy to lose your momentum teaching and preaching through the book of Exodus. And frankly, the second half of the book isn't always preached as often. You've got a lot of case laws. Exodus chapter 21, I just have a note here of an example. Verse 28, when an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox must be stoned and its meat may not be eaten, but the ox owner is innocent. However, if the ox was in the habit of goring, kind of habitual gorer, I guess, and its owner has been warned yet does not restrain it and it kills a man or a woman, the ox must be stoned and its owner must also be put to death. Now, I've preached this part of the Bible. I think it's great for preaching, but I can understand why people feel like, ooh, that's going to be really difficult. You know, what am I going to do with that kind of feeling? Then you get a lot of very detailed instructions for making the tabernacle, which I remind you, if you haven't looked at Exodus recently, are basically repeated twice verbatim. So Exodus 25 to 28 is pretty identical to Exodus 36 to 38. So if you think the tabernacle is kind of challenging to preach through one time, it's going to be definitely challenging to preach through two times. And, you know, in terms of drama, one of the best things you have going for you in the second half of the book is the golden calf. That's a great story, lots of humorous moments, lots of dramatic teaching. But my point is simply, some of the material in the second half of Exodus is sometimes considered to be harder to preach, and partly because it's not all narrative. How do you preach a legal code? That may be more challenging than how do you tell a story. What do you do with a set of blueprints in terms of homiletics? It's easy to lose narrative momentum. But then there's also this problem, and that is the problem of coherence. And some secular, skeptical scholars have said, you know, this is really two books. It was never, you know, it wasn't originally put together. You've got this narrative part, and then these things were added later on. And there's a sense among some who look at the book that it doesn't really hold together all that well. And part of the solution or part of the answer to that is if we can identify, no, there's really a narrative thread here. There is a melodic line. Now, how do you identify or find a melodic line? I want to give you a couple of tools for doing that, and I think all of these tools can be illustrated in the book of Exodus. One thing you want to do is look for something repeated through the book, and not merely repeated, but something that is repeated that also seems to be close to the center of its message. Something that runs through the book, something that's thematic, won't just occur in one place, it'll be present in many places, and preferably something that is part of the end stress of the book, or perhaps cycle of stories, something that you are moving towards as you work through this part of Scripture. Even better, if you're working with an Old Testament narrative, that you have some New Testament indications that affirm that that's part of the theme or melodic line of the book. I think Elijah is a particularly good example of this. You turn to the book of James, chapter 5, and what is it, out of all the things it could say about the prophet Elijah, James identifies him as a man of prayer. And Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, yet he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and for 3 years and 6 months it did not rain on the land. Then he prayed again, and the sky gave rain, and the land produced its fruit. Now, that may be simply an example in the book of James, but it raises a question for me, and that is, have I really noticed everything in the Elijah stories about prayer? And is the story of his life even more about prayer than I perhaps first noticed? And I think for me the answer has been, when you go back to it, yes, very much so, there's a lot to say, and there's a unity around the theme of prayer, and it opens up new areas of meaning, perhaps things we might have missed in Elijah. Now, in the case of Exodus, there's an important word that gets repeated in many important places. For example, if you turn to Exodus chapter 14, the opening verses, it's a word that appears in this climactic chapter, which tells the story of Israel crossing the Red Sea. It's the central act of salvation in the book of Exodus. It's one of maybe two central acts of salvation in the Old Testament. Definitely demands our attention. And there's an important word that gets repeated in the narrative. It's one of the key words in all of Scripture. It's the word glory. The Lord said this to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and camp in front of Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea. You must camp in front of Baal Zephon, facing it by the sea. Pharaoh will say of the Israelites, they are wandering around the land in confusion. The wilderness has boxed them in. I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. Then I will receive glory by means of Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." This verse 4, explains why God is doing what he's doing, which is typical of salvation history. God doesn't just do things, he also says things, and often the things that he says are there to explain what he has done. And here he says, very plainly, his purpose in all of this, what's happening between Moses and Pharaoh, what God is doing in Israel and Egypt, it is all about getting glory for himself, defeating Pharaoh, and thereby demonstrating that he really is the Lord. That intention gets reiterated and confirmed and expanded down in verse 17. I'm going to harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. God's giving more details. There's more prophetic information here. And his chariots, and I will receive glory by means of Pharaoh, all his army and his chariots and horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I receive glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. As you may know, there's no exclamation mark on your Hebrew keyboard. The biblical way of doing exclamation marks is simply to repeat things. And when you see things repeated in the Bible, that's definitely something to pay attention to, because it's there by way of emphasis. God has a desire to gain glory for himself. That is to reveal his godness, the weightiness of his divine being. I sometimes think of the glory of God not only as the weightiness of his divine being, thinking of the etymology of the term glory, but also as the sum total of his divine attributes, as a God for whom the sum of his parts is even greater than the sum of his parts. It's everything about God put together, you might say. And here in Exodus 14, God is committing himself to a display of his divine glory by, at one and the same time, rescuing his people and defeating the Egyptians. Interestingly, and I think importantly, wisely, the theme of glory, specifically the vocabulary of glory, is picked up by the Israelites in chapter 15. This is the song of Moses and the sea. The people have been delivered, and they recognize that their God is glorious through his deliverance. They were told, God's going to glorify himself. Here's what he's going to do. He's going to rescue you, and that's going to be for his glory. And when God does that, they want to give him the glory that he deserves. I will sing to the Lord, verse 1. He is highly exalted. He has thrown the horse and its rider into the sea. Or in some translations, he has triumphed gloriously. That's the vocabulary there. You get the same theme picked up in verse 21. Miriam is basically repeating this theme of glorious exaltation from her brother. Notice verse 6. God's right hand is glorious in power, the glory of God's power and his justice. Verse 11, the superior glory of God as compared to the gods of Egypt. Who is like you among the gods? Who is like you glorious in holiness, revered with praises, performing wonders? The people of God are glorifying God with their praise. There's a particular kind of triumph that the people are celebrating. It's a glorious triumph. And that comes up in the words that they use to give God the praise. And already here in chapter 15, you see that God is achieving his purpose in the Exodus. He wanted to have glory for his name, and now the people are giving it to him, and he has it, the glory that he desired. Then you see similar vocabulary in chapter 16. The children of Israel are out in the wilderness. They're desperate for food. You've got their complaints. They're grumbling. They wish that they could die. All the kinds of desperate kinds of complaints people give when they're grumpy about things. God responds with a promise of provision. And here's how Moses and Aaron explain that promise to the people. I'm going to rain bread from heaven for you, verse 4. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. I'm going to test them to see whether they follow my instructions. There's everything in verse 5 about the sixth day for the seventh day. And then in verse 6, Moses and Aaron say, this evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning, you will see the Lord's glory. He doesn't say here, in the morning, the bread's going to be there. In the morning, God's going to provide. He heightens the language, right? Maybe I should say they heighten the language, Moses and Aaron, by emphasizing that they will see the glory of God. That's what they will see in the morning. And here's a different aspect of God's glory. And one of the things that's happening as you work through the story is you are seeing different aspects of the glory of God. His redemption, his justice, his holiness, his power. Here, his provision. It's something that is refracted like a diamond. You see the different glorious aspects of the glory of God. And God does exactly what he promised. And notice what is said in verse 10. God does provide for his people. And with that provision of bread, he makes an extraordinary demonstration of his glory. Aaron is speaking to the entire Israelite community. They turned toward the wilderness, and there, in a cloud, the Lord's glory appeared. There is a a glory cloud, the Shekinah glory. It's a visible manifestation of the invisible glory of God, what Jonathan Edwards called an effulgence and emanation of light shining from a luminary. That's the glory of God in its visible appearance. And God is accommodating himself to human understanding. We cannot see the fullness of God's glory. We can't see the full glory of an invisible God. But on certain occasions, he makes his glory apparent by appearing in a radiant cloud of glorious splendor. And so his purpose here, he wanted to show his glory to Egypt, but he is now also showing his glory to his people. This glory cloud appears again in chapter 24. This is the remarkable incident when Moses and the elders go up the mountain. The nation is gathered at the foot of Mount Sinai. Moses prepares the people for a renewal of the covenant. He makes burnt offerings. They have sacrifices. They read the book of the covenant. And really you have a whole kind of worship service here in Exodus chapter 24. The people bind themselves to God in a solemn oath and a covenant is made. And after all of that happens at the foot of the mountain, Moses and the elders go up. Verse 9, Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of Israel's elders, and they saw the God of Israel. Beneath his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire stone as clear as the sky itself. God did not harm the Israelite nobles. They saw him and they ate and they drank. It's a covenant meal. It's a foretaste of eternal fellowship. And we're told that Moses and the elders saw God, although actually the only thing that is described is the pavement under God's feet. That's as high up as they look. And even that is something full of majesty and splendor. And there are great mysteries here, but it is evident that Moses and the elders are approaching to the glory of God. And that specific vocabulary then gets used in verses 15 and following. When Moses actually goes up by himself, he enters the cloud, and it is said, verse 16, that the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called to Moses from the cloud. The appearance of the Lord's glory to the Israelites was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop, and Moses enters that cloud in verse 18. He is there 40 days and 40 nights. It is further up and further in. There is a more personal encounter with the glory of God, not just seeing it in acts of judgment and rescue, not just experiencing it in the provision of manna and quail, not just seeing it in a more distant cloud of glory, but actually entering into the glory of the Lord, this fiery cloud of divine glory. This glory of the Lord is also reflected in the tabernacle. Now, I'm gonna develop this theme through Exodus in other ways. All I'm doing right now is just showing you the vocabulary of glory at these key moments in the book of Exodus. You get a few little hints of glory in the instructions around the tabernacle. Chapter 28, verses 1 and 2, for example. God is talking about how he wants garments to be made for Aaron and the priests, and he's explaining their purpose. Notice the end of verse 2. They are for glory and for beauty. And that's not fully unpacked for us. We have to maybe think about and infer exactly what is meant here. God obviously has an aesthetic, an appreciation here. He wants something that is beautiful for his priests. The priests are to be set apart, specifically the high priest, and his garments also should reflect that setting apartness, and they should be glorious, presumably for this reason, that the high priest is representing the people of God, and so something of the glory of God should be reflected, even in the garments that he wears, that there's a connection between the attributes of a glorious God and the garments of a priest who reflects the glory of that God. There's something in the purity of the whiteness of these garments, their dazzling beauty of the gems that were on the high priest's breastplate, the regal majesty of the gold. All of these things are reflective of the glory of God. And similarly, at the end of chapter 28, or towards the end in verse 40, when the headgear is described and some of the other accessories, I guess you would call them, to priestly attire, tunics, sashes, headbands. This is to give them glory and beauty. Then in chapter 29, you have something perhaps even more explicit. God has been giving very detailed, careful instructions about the ordination of priests. And when he gets to the end of those instructions, he steps back a little bit and he expresses his wider intentions for the tabernacle. Verse 42 refers to the tent of meeting, where God will speak with his people. Then verse 43, I will also meet with the Israelites there, and that place will be consecrated by my glory. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar. I will also consecrate Aaron and his sons to serve me as priests. I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. See, the whole tabernacle will be sanctified and made holy by the presence of God, which is said explicitly to be a glorious presence. The very glory of God himself will make the tabernacle holy and the priest holy and his sons holy. And then the people will know this really is the living God, the glory of the glorious God with all of his mighty attributes. And here is now a further manifestation of the glory of God, perhaps a different aspect of his glory. It's his glory in covenant relationship with his people. There's something personal about the relationship that God has with his people, that they can call him their God, that he will call them his people, and that is displaying something of the glory of God. Then this takes perhaps an even more personal turn when you get to chapter 33 and Moses has his encounter with God. And I think chapter 33, verse 18 is so climactic. Here you see so clearly that Moses understands what God is up to, that he's seeing this theme of God's glory, and he understands it's the heart of God to bring his people closer to his glory, and he is emboldened by the promises that God has given. And so he asks God, he does say, please, but it's pretty emphatic, please let me see your glory. I think that's a clear indication that Moses has been living the melodic line of Exodus and wants to experience it even more deeply in his own life. Now, God tells Moses, of course, he can't bear a full revelation of the divine glory. Nobody can see the glory of God and live, but he will at least allow Moses to see his goodness, and Moses is sheltered in the rock, and he is able to see at least the backside of God's glory, the passing by of his glory, which even just getting the little glimpse of that is glorious beyond anything we can imagine. And then the final place that the vocabulary of glory appears in Exodus is right at the very end. I've already mentioned, look for the end stress. That's often important for understanding something that is thematic and unified. And typically, authors do tell you what they are doing at the beginning and or at the end of what they write. So this ending is bound to be significant. And what you see at the end of the Exodus is the most impressive display of the glory of God that you have seen to date. The chapter, I think, as I read it, you get a building suspense because very meticulously, somewhat laboriously, certainly methodically, and arguably slowly, Moses carefully erects the tabernacle piece by piece. He puts each part into its place. And in one sense, there's, I guess, a lot of action. There's certainly a lot of verbs. There's a description. Moses does this, then he does the next thing, then he does the thing after that. But there's a sense that there's nothing really happening. But the suspense is building because God has said that he's going to live with his people. And will he really do that? Is that really going to happen? That's the thing that you're waiting to find out. And then Moses finishes the work. End of verse 33. And what happens next? The cloud covered the tent of meeting. Exodus 40, verse 34. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was unable to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud rested on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. What an awesome What awesome verses. What an awesome thing to have happen at the end of this book. Here is arguably the greatest climax in the book of Exodus. Sometimes people are a little critical of Exodus because you get the climactic deliverance from the Red Sea in chapter 14. That's way too early to have a climax. Unless you realize it's a story that builds, it's kind of like a volcano where the lava is coming up and then it settles down again and then it finally erupts at the end. I think that's the movement of the book of Exodus. And here is the glory of the Lord coming down to fill a dwelling place where he can meet with his people. And it's so glorious, Moses can't even enter. How ironic, after all the buildup that we've had, here is the one place in the whole world where people can meet with a holy God, unholy people meeting with a holy God, a glorious God. And yet when the tabernacle is built, it is filled with so much glory that Moses can't even go inside. And obviously, there must be more to the story of God and his people. This can't be the final moment. Even this is climactic in the context of Exodus, but if God is really going to be with his people and have them fully experience his glory, obviously there's going to have to be a climax somewhere beyond this, something even greater than what we experience here in the book of Exodus. Now, all of that is just the explicit wording of glory, and I'm actually just getting started with melodic line. I think that's a really good start, because even though the word is not all that frequent, it shows up a fair number of times, and it's showing up in key places, key moments, key narrative turns, climactic events. And it is also often used not just to show what is happening, but also to show why it's happening. I mean, there's a purpose behind it. God has said, my purpose is to display my glory. So there's something purposeful about this melodic line. Now, I've said this along the way, and I'll just highlight it briefly. I think as you see glory used in this place, glory used in that place, glory used in another place, you're getting a bigger picture of who God is and a greater understanding, a wider glimpse of what the glory of God is. And you could go back through all of the passages we've looked at and kind of identify, now here's the kind of glory in this passage, here's the kind of glory in that passage, but it also is more than the sum of its parts as you work your way through the Bible. And I think by the time you've looked at these passages, whatever the melodic line of Exodus is, it's got to have something somewhere to do with the glory of God. Now, where else can we look for confirmation of a melodic line? I think we can look in other places in Scripture. Particularly in the Old Testament, we can find greater clarity in the New Testament. I won't do this in detail, but you could demonstrate this from the book of Psalms, because there are a number of key psalms that celebrate the Exodus, and most or maybe even all of them indicate in one way or another God is saving people for his glory. The psalmist looked at the Exodus, understood what the purpose was, and as he praises God for the Exodus, he says, I need to use the word glory to describe what God did in saving his people. So, for example, Psalm 106, well, now maybe Broadman Holman's doing me wrong here, because I thought the word glory was in verse 5. Rejoice in the joy of your nation, boast about your heritage. But in any case, the psalm here is giving glory to God. It is an act of giving glory to God simply by virtue of its worship. You also see Psalm 106, verse 47. Yeah, there's not glory language here, but there is in other translations. That might be something to look into a little more greater depth. You can also see in the Song of Moses, Psalm 90, as I think simply the fact that these are psalms of praise tells you something, but there's a sense of the glory of God that comes up in the psalmist. Then you have a number of very significant passages in the New Testament. One of them is Luke chapter 9. And it's not surprising, if the Exodus is the great salvation event of the Old Testament, it's not surprising that it's going to be talked about in the New Testament. Luke 9, of course, is the story of the Transfiguration. And you have a revelation of the glory of the Son of God, Jesus Christ, in the context of a revelation of the glory of Moses. Jesus appears to his disciples in dazzling splendor. Moses and Elijah are also tabernacled with him, and Luke says that they appear in glory. There's something glorious about their appearance. It's calling to mind for the disciples the glory of the Exodus in the Old Testament. And then what appears? A glory cloud appears. Verse 34, while Jesus was saying this, a cloud appeared and overshadowed them. They became afraid as they entered the cloud. Here again we have the Shekinah glory. And I think if you know the book of Exodus, it's not surprising that if you want to see the glory of the Son of God, Moses would be there. And there may be a lot of reasons for that. What is it that Moses wants to talk with Jesus about? He wants to talk with him about his Exodus. That's the vocabulary that is used here. His departure, perhaps referring to his death specifically, maybe also referring to his ascension into glory. But my point simply is that the gospel work of Jesus Christ, what he is about to do for the salvation of his people from their sins, and the revelation of his person as a glorious person, that is set in the context of the Exodus, and that's very much in continuity with what we've identified as thematic and melodic. When you go with the disciples up the Mount of Transfiguration, you are breathing the glory atmosphere of the book of Exodus. Or consider the marvelous passage on the New Covenant in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, a very significant passage for interpreting the ministry of Moses. Paul's talking about the New Covenant, its superior grace and glory to the Old Covenant. And to emphasize, to make this point, Paul emphasizes the glory of the ministry of Moses, refers specifically to the way that the face of Moses would shine when he had been in the presence of God. That incident described for us in Exodus chapter 34, Paul wants to recount some of those details. Moses, when he went into the presence of God, became so resplendent, his face became so radiant that people were scared to come near him. Not even his own brother could look Moses in the face when he had been in the presence of the glory of God, so he put a veil over. And then Paul's point from this, verse 7, now if the ministry of death, chiseled in letters of stone, came with glory, so that the sons of Israel were not able to look directly at Moses' face because of the glory from his face, a fading glory, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? Now, there's so many things we could say about this passage, its implications for Exodus, but the point I just want to make is, whatever Paul is saying here, it depends on the fact that you recognize that the ministry of God through Moses was a ministry of glory, that it can be characterized as a glorious ministry, which glory now is superseded by the coming of Christ. And then in the verses that follow, so much is said about glory. Verses 9 to 11, if the ministry of condemnation had glory, the ministry of righteousness overflows with even more glory. In fact, what had been glorious is not glorious in this case because of the glory that surpasses it. For if what was fading away was glorious, what endures will be even more glorious. There is a relationship here between the glory of Exodus and the glory of Christ. You get something similar in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 3, which compares Moses to Christ explicitly in terms of Christ being more glorious. Now, I think we're building a pretty good case here. It's the vocabulary of glory. It's other passages in the Bible that help you understand what is happening in Exodus and framing things in terms of a ministry of glory. But I don't want to just limit myself to the vocabulary of glory as if this is sort of a word hunt. I also want to think thematically about glory and notice some of the other places where there are things that are glorious or pertaining to glorious in the book of Exodus. One such place would be Exodus chapter 3. I don't know what to call the burning bush if you don't call it glorious. Because of its fiery brightness, because of its miraculous nature, because of what is revealed about the glorious attributes of God as the great I Am. That's a name that conveys something of the glory of God. Or, thematically, think of the demand that Moses makes of Pharaoh on behalf of his God. The demand Moses makes is not simply let my people go. It's not just a message of liberation for the sake of freedom. It is more specifically a demand to let them go and worship. Exodus chapter 3, verse 18, this 3 days journey into the wilderness to make sacrifices to God. Exodus 5, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. And there are other examples of this scattered in through the dialogue that Moses has with Pharaoh. And when Pharaoh finally relents, chapter 12, he says that he is letting the Israelites go to serve the Lord. Now, some commentators regard this as a little disingenuous, maybe even deceptive on the part of Moses. I mean, he's not just asking for permission to go and worship. He's asking really for permission to leave Egypt altogether. But this theme of worship, of holy service to God through praise, that's the thing that God desires from his people. And so Moses really is asking Pharaoh for the very thing that God wants and that the people most want to give. And here's a way of thinking about it. Rather than continuing to work for Pharaoh's glory, to build his monuments, to raise up his kingdom, the people now will worship their God. That is to say, they will give him the glory. The whole struggle here is a struggle over who gets the glory, which helps explain, I think, why God delivered his people the way that he did. I mean, I suppose in his power and majesty, God could have skipped plagues 1 through 8, maybe even skipped plagues 1 through 9, and just gone, you know, right for darkness and death at the end. But Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, makes God's purpose clear. I will pass through the land on that night. This is instructions for the Passover. I will execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt, which is actually what he's been doing from the very beginning, because the manifestations of the plagues connected to the Egyptian deities, the god of the Nile. You turn the river of Nile to blood. That's not just an economic disaster. It's not merely a symbol. It is actually a defeat of the power of the Egyptian god of the Nile, the god of fertility, defeated when the country was overrun with frogs. That was part of the symbolism of the frog as it was worshipped as a deity, the bull gods defeated by the disease on the cattle, and so forth, culminating at the end in the defeat of the two greatest gods of Egypt, the sun god and Pharaoh himself. Those were the greatest gods in the pantheon. But you can see that God, there was an ongoing manifestation of the glory of God in his superiority to every other deity. There's a more complete demonstration of the glory of God that comes by the time you work your way through all 10 of the plagues. Or the 10 commandments. The preamble, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. The 10 commandments are starting with a claim that God will not share his glory with any other god. And the rest of the commandments are spelling out for you how to glorify God and how to glorify God in the way that you relate to other people. It's not just the vocabulary of glory. It's the meaning of glory, what it means to glorify, what it means for God to be glorious and for us to glorify him. And so I think all of this is closely related to this melodic line of, if you wanted to put it simply, this is a story of the people of God saved for the glory of God. There's a salvation deliverance. That's what an exodus is. But it has a purpose that is part and parcel of the purpose, and that is to magnify and advance and exalt the glory of God. Now, let me just say a few things about how this will help you teach or to preach the book of Exodus. It's a theme, this theme of glory, that is very close to the central message of the Bible and the main goal of the Christian life. I love the Westminster Shorter Catechism. What's the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Now, that's very much the kind of book that Exodus is, showing us that this is our purpose and how to do it. This is the whole goal of the Christian life, to glorify God. And somehow it makes sense that the book in the Old Testament that focuses on the central act of salvation in the Old Testament has for its main theme the glory of God, because that is what salvation is about. It's about God getting the glory. And so as we preach through Exodus, we return again and again to focus on the one thing that ought to be the focus for all of life, and that is the glory of God. It's not surprising to me that when Jonathan Edwards wrote his famous book on the end for which God created the world, you will see him commenting on all of the glory passages in Exodus. He works his way through all of those passages. As Edwards was thinking about identifying and then expounding this theme of the glory of God as the chief end of all existence, Exodus was one of the main places he was drawing his source material from. I think knowing this melodic line helps you understand everything in the book better. I'm reminded of the old commercial that Philips used to do. I still don't exactly know what the Philips company does, but what the ad was is, we don't make the light bulb, we make it brighter. And so even where glory is not present or you don't notice it, it's illuminating things in the book of Exodus. It helps you really understand the dramatic tension between God and Pharaoh. It's not just a conflict between two nations. It's not just a perennial story of oppression or genocide. It's the honor of God that is at stake. Will he be glorified or not? That's why this is such a dramatic conflict, why it has to be decided in the outcome of God and his grace. You know, the problem with Pharaoh is he won't let people serve anyone else. It's all about his own glory. This dramatic tension comes through very clearly in chapter 9, verses 16 and 17. I have let you live for this purpose, to show you my power and to make my name known in all the earth. This is what God is saying through Moses to Pharaoh. Yet you are still acting arrogantly against my people by not letting them go. Look, I have a purpose here to glorify myself among the nations, and you're standing in the way of that purpose. That's God's message to Pharaoh. I've already commented that the theme of glory helps us make sense of the plagues. I think the theme of glory helps us understand why God destroyed the Egyptians. He didn't just deliver the Israelites, but there is something glorious about God executing judgment. And for it to be the fuller manifestation of the glory of God, it had to be an act of justice as well as an act of deliverance. When you understand that, then you're ready to sing with the Israelites in chapter 15 and not be squeamish in chapter 15 about the fact that the people are cheering for the destruction of their enemies. That's actually the point, that God would be glorified in his justice, and you're ready to sing praise right along with the Israelites. I think we understand the importance not only of the Ten Commandments, but also the case laws that follow the Ten Commandments, the goring of the ox and all of that. We want to live a life that more fully glorifies God. And so rather than just giving us Ten Commandments in their generalities, now you get specific. Here are specific ways that you can live a life that is glorifying to God. I also think this theme of glory helps preserve the dramatic tension through the whole long second part of the book. There's still a question, is God really going to come and live with his people after all that they've done, all the things they've done wrong? Is he still going to come and live with his people in a glorious way? That suspense builds up. You see so clearly why the golden calf is such a massive setback to that, because the people are going to give their glory to something else. God's building, he's up there with Moses to build this building so his glory can be with his people, but they're not willing to wait for that. They want to have their own glory in a different way. And when you see this theme of glory and what God is really after, you see why it's such an outrage. Now, there are many other themes in Exodus: covenant, answered prayer, other land and seed that's picked up from Genesis and is part of the bigger theme of the Torah as a whole. All of those are important themes, but I think you have here a melodic line that brings joy to the heart, helps you apply Exodus to the Christian life. Here's a kind of microcosm of the Christian life: God robbed of his glory, but actually wanting to regain that glory and wanting to do a work of grace in us so that we would give him the glory. And whether we think of that entering into the glory of God as going up in our own ascension to glory, or whether we think of the glory coming down the way it does in the New Jerusalem, either way, God's purpose is for us to be united with him in a place of absolute glory, which is a way of saying that the melodic line of Exodus will be your eternal theme. So here is a song to learn how to sing along with Moses, a song to enter into the joy of as part of the part of the music of your salvation. Thank you so much for this invitation. It's been great to be here.